Welcome to
Based on a True Crime Story,
a podcast where we watch movies and do other things. Can't build me up like that. A podcast where we talk about a true crime incident and the movie that was inspired by it.
Yes.
This week we are talking about the Billionaire Boys Club.
I almost thought you were going to say Bombay Bicycle Club.
Well, we do talk about the Bombay Bicycle Club.
Yes.
In the context of the Billionaire Boys Club.
So we are going all out, all 80s.
It is. And it's 80s Beverly Hills.
Indeed.
So how appropriate.
Yes.
All right.
So this time, Kelly did the research of the crime, and I watched the fabulous made-for-TV cheesy movie from 1987.
And it's real crimes and crimes against fashion.
Indeed.
So I got my information from, there was an Investigation Discovery article / special about the Billionaire's Boy Club. They really didn't do a lot of interesting titling for these things. And then Dominic Dunn had a series called Power, Privilege, and Justice.
I love Dominic Dunn.
Yeah, and he had one about the Billionaire Boys Club. Oh. And then also Wikipedia.
Wikipedia.
All right. The Billionaire Boys Club was an investing and social club organized in 1983 by Joseph Henry Hunt, who was born Joseph Henry Gamsky in Southern California. It was originally simply named BBC, the initials of Bombay Bicycle Club, which was a restaurant Hunt had frequented as a young man in Chicago. Yep. The get-rich-quick treatment the group offered to clients added up to what was essentially one big Ponzi scheme. The club enticed the sons of wealthy families from the Harvard School for Boys in the Los Angeles area with get-rich-quick schemes. Given their inexperience and difficulty succeeding independently of their family's wealth, an organization like the BBC proved attractive to these young men. Due to the reputation of the organization for being composed of young, inexperienced men from moneyed families, it was jokingly referred to as the Billionaire Boys Club.
Sounds like a great name.
But, I mean, they weren't billionaires. Their family had money, and most of them weren't billionaires. And they also weren't boys, because they were mostly in their 20s. But, you know, whatever.
Some men act like boys.
And some are boys and to men. So, born in 1960, Joe Hunt began his life as Joseph Henry Gamsky, a hardworking kid from a middle-class family who achieved academic success early on and displayed powerfully focused ambition. He grew up in Van Nuys, and his father was emotionally distant. Does that do bad things to kids?
Emotionally distant. I thought you were, his father was like a day laborer or something like that. Nope.
No.
He was emotionally distant.
His father worked at a hypnosis clinic.
Oh, that's not shifty at all.
Yeah, where he used young Joe as a guinea pig on self-hypnosis.
I've never heard of that.
No, that's because it's an L.A. thing.
It's his lesser-known cousin.
Where he used young Joe as a guinea pig on self-hypnosis. I wonder where Joe learned the art of swindling. As a teen, Joe Gamsky won a scholarship to L.A.'s prestigious Harvard School for Boys, now known as the Harvard Westlake School in L.A., where he felt out of place among the hyper-privileged sons of the Beverly Hills elite, kids for whom money was never an object and nothing seemed off-limits. After graduation, Joe headed to USC to study accounting. At 19, he took and passed the state CPA exam. He would later tell people he was the youngest person in the state of California to do so. He wasn't. He got bored of college and dropped out his sophomore year, and he applied for a position as an accountant at a large LA-based firm, stating he was preparing to graduate and provided them with his CPA exam results. He was hired, but again got bored. He decided to move to Chicago. I've been to Chicago. It's no LA. And work at the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. He had no experience, but a ton of ambition and confidence, which doesn't make you a great trader.
It'll take you far.
Yeah. He lost all the money he invested, and he started taking investments from others, even though he had no license. And he did well for a while, but then once he started losing their money and not delivering on his many promises, one of his investors turned him in.
Busted.
He was suspended by the Chicago Mercantile Exchange for unsound trading practices. Gamsky returned to L.A. in 1981, reinventing himself as a go-go deal broker, Joe Hunt, founder of BBC Consolidated of North America.
Go-go deal broker sounds like a go-go dancer something. I don't know. Anyway, sorry.
Yep. Newly bold and confidently charismatic, Hunt charmed his former Harvard school classmates. He claimed he made it through USC's business program in 2 years by inventing a foolproof, top-secret investment system, and naturally, he wanted to share the wealth with them for the right price, of course.
Mm-hmm.
The BBC operated with what Joe referred to as the paradox philosophy, which meant that the ends justified the means, always. His first two investors slash employees were Dean Carney and Ben Dosty. Next came Tom and David May, who were heirs to the May Company fortune. Hunt opened a trading account at Cantor Fitzgerald and began buying and selling high-risk commodities. He focused the BBC's investment efforts on alluring fields such as cutting-edge technology, high-tech machinery, and luxury automobile imports. It was the 80s. Who could resist?
It's a decade of excess.
And decadence.
Yes.
The wealthy families Hunt grew up around funneled major cash into the BBC, funding phony subsidiaries with fancy names such as Microgenesis, West Cars, and Financial Futures, and international marketing. The BBC even started a business converting European sports cars to American standards, but ended up driving their investments as opposed to converting them.
Well, what fun is that?
Yeah, they were at first successful and leased an expensive suite of offices and all of those German sports cars we just talked about.
Mm-hmm.
In reality, though, all that money served only to create and prop up the illusion that the BBC was actually conducting any real business at all. Every cent that came in simply vanished. The BBC started using new investors' money to pay off old investors. Hello, Ponzi scheme! Despite the BBC members' Wiltshire Boulevard condos, Rolls-Royce collections, and other flashy show-off materials, after 2 years of investing, backers were asking troublesome questions. Hunt then sought to find a fresh mark with deep enough pockets to keep the scam going long enough until he could find another mark.
Mm-hmm.
That's when he met 40-year-old Ron Levin. They both saw themselves in one another and were attracted to the possibility of working with and competing against each other.
Sounds like a match made in heaven.
Or hell.
Or hell.
Ron Levin not only shared expensive taste and an ostentatious manner with the BBC, he too was a straight-up fraud.
Yep.
Joe tried to get Levin to invest in the BBC. He thought if he could get a big chunk of money to invest in the commodities market, he could turn it all around. Their larcenous and lethal association began when Levin gave Hunt access to a $5 million account for commodities trading. He insisted on using his own accounts, though. BBC immediately dove into the loot and split it up. Unfortunately, no actual loot existed. The BBC con artists got conned themselves.
For shame.
Levin convinced an investment firm to make it look like he had $5 million to finance a documentary on Joe Hunt. And while pretending to make the documentary, Levin used the bogus account to attract real money from other investors. Hunt eventually caught on and came up with what seemed like a reasonable way of getting Levin to fork over what he owed. To be precise, the BBC would kill him and then steal whatever money he had.
Sounds like an excellent plan.
Yes. On June 6, 1984, Joe Hunt and Jim Pittman, who was a bodyguard for the BBC, visited Ron Levin. The next day, they brought a check for $1.5 million into the office. When Joe took the check to the bank, though, it bounced. And 2 days later, Ron was reported missing when a group of friends showed up at his Beverly Hills condo on their way to catch a flight to New York for the weekend. Ron, the consummate traveling party man, was not there. The police, well acquainted with Levin's own antics and previous police record, dismissed Ron's friends. They assumed he had skipped town before getting caught up in another con.
Because that's what everyone does.
Yes. The next day, Ron Levin checked into a suite at the Plaza Hotel in New York, where he stayed for several days, racking up and exorbitant charges for meals, limo services, and the cost of the room. They attempted to run the credit card that was on file for Levin, but it was declined. And so they put a double lock on the door, effectively locking Levin's possessions inside. Later that day, security spotted Levin carrying an attaché case that had been locked in the room and stopped him. He took flight, running through a glass door.
Ouch.
Yeah. He was apprehended, and when the police asked how he had obtained the attaché case, he said he broke the door down. He was arrested for the damage to his room and the front of the hotel, as well as his outstanding bill. A tall stranger showed up and paid his bail, the retainer for the attorney, as well as all of the hotel charges. That stranger, Joe Hunt.
Of course.
Ron Levin actually was Jim Pittman.
Oh.
But that wasn't discovered until after Jim had left town. Back at the offices of the BBC, investors and members began to get disillusioned when Joe was no longer fulfilling his grand promises. The only two members who stuck around were his best friend and second-in-command, Dean Carney, and Reza Adlaminia. Reza was a relatively new BBC member whose father, Hidayat, fled Iran with a large fortune. However, his assets in Iran were frozen, so Reza didn't have access to them. Hidayat disappeared, and people assumed it was political and related to his fleeing of Iran. The May brothers were past the point of frustration and went to the police with the tale of how they, as well as others, were swindled out of their money. They also revealed that Joe and Jim had held a meeting shortly after Ron Levin's disappearance and gloated to the BBC that they had taken care of him. This prompted the Beverly Hills Police Department to gain a search warrant for Levin's apartment, where they found a 7-page handwritten letter entitled To-Do List. It was a step-by-step list of how Levin was gotten rid of.
I mean, who makes a list?
A very type A personality.
I suppose.
It included items such as kill dog and tape mouth.
Yes.
Not the mouth of the dog. Dog, the mouth,
yeah.
Of Levin.
Yeah.
On October 22nd, Joe Hunt was arrested for the murder of Ron Levin. According to Dean Carney, the BBC's second-in-command who turned state's evidence, Hunt and BBC security chief Jim Pittman forced Levin to sign over a $1.5 million check, then shot him in the head and ditched the body in a canyon. Carney's testimony, coupled with Hunt's handwritten to-do list regarding Levin's murder that the cops found, led to life in prison for Hunt and a plea deal for Pittman. That's no small achievement for the prosecution, as Ron Levin's body was never found. Hunt's attorneys also quickly pointed out that the to-do list didn't include the task of kill Levin, and trotted out numerous witnesses who claimed to have seen Levin after that day in June. But a body definitely did surface, along with still more charges of murder. At around the same time Hunt and Pittman murdered Levin, BBC member Reza Aslaminia was alleged to have offered up his Iranian millionaire father as another potential source of ill-gained BBC income. Dean Carney told the court that the group's plan was to kidnap Hidayat and transport him while locked in a steamer trunk from San Francisco to a Los Angeles safe house, where BBC members would torture him until he signed over his fortune to his son. It might have worked, too, if it weren't for those meddling kids.
Right?
No. Oh, it might have worked if Hidayat didn't die while stuffed into the trunk during the journey.
Air holes. Yes. Air is important.
It's the very first thing. You put a butterfly into a jar, you gotta punch air holes into the top.
Exactly.
3 months later, authorities found the victim's bones scattered in the wilderness, picked clean by coyotes.
Delicious.
In 1988, a jury convicted Reza and fellow BBC member Arvind Dosti for Hidayat's murder. 10 years later, however, those convictions were overturned and in time dismissed. Joe Hunt, meanwhile, acted as his own attorney at a separate trial for masterminding the Hidayat Aslamania plot. He pointed the finger at state's evidence, Dean Carney. He said that they had kidnapped Hidayat at his behest, as his departure from Iran had upset the Ayatollah Khomeini. And I had to write that phonetically. I didn't
Ayatollah
spell it.
Khomeini?
I didn't even spell it correct. They had taken him to the safe house in the trunk and kept him in the basement where Dean had decided to murder him one day while everyone was out. Despite having no legal training and an outlandish story, the trial resulted in a hung jury, 8-4, with the majority in favor of finding Hunt not guilty.
Oh.
To date, Joe Hunt remains the only defendant in California history to represent himself in a capital murder case and not get the death penalty. They decided to have another trial for that particular murder. And that is the story of the Billionaire Boys Club.
All right.
Now let's talk about 80s heartthrob Judd Nelson. And I will say, I know that he's a despicable human being, but Joe Hunt was kind of a dreamboat.
Was he?
Yeah.
Yeah, so as I said previously, this movie is totally pure 80s. I mean, the amount of synthesizer used in this movie.
Do you think there were keytars?
Oh, maybe. It could have been keytars. But the amount of synthesizer sounds in this movie,
That's how you know trouble's coming. That's what they do in 90210.
I didn't mean to kick you. I'm sorry. But it's how, I mean, seriously, it is obscene how much synthesizer music is in this. The movie starts with a disclaimer that this motion picture is based on court testimony, police records, and events in the life of Joe Hunt. However, some of the character names have been changed to protect their identity.
I just told you all of them, so.
Yeah.
Burn.
Movie. So, Judd Nelson is Joe Hunt, and given his haircut, this was probably filmed around the same time as St. Elmo's Fire.
Yes.
Yes.
With the side sweat bangs.
Mm-hmm. So, this aired in 1987, which was the same year that Joe Hunt was convicted of murder. And NBC aired this movie actually twice, in 87 and again in 1989. And YouTube, you can watch it for free if you're really interested in spending 3 hours of your life that you might not get back with a lot of synthesizer.
That is a real resounding endorsement.
Isn't it, though? Okay. So the movie begins with a man on the witness stand talking about Joe Hunt and a list. And while questioning and cross-examination goes on, the film flashes back to Joe Hunt meeting up with friends and acquaintances and telling them all about his banner idea of an investment firm called BBC.
Every time I say it, though, I want to be like, ABC, BBD, East Coast Family.
or say BBC in my British accent.
No, don't do that.
Okay. Mm-mm. Joe wins them over with two pieces of information that basically anything can be right through the correct perspective, and that the boys come from money families who think they are too young or not ready to access the family money.
What was that? What did I say that was called? Philosophy. What was that? Hold on.
Paradigm.
No.
Oh.
Damn it, where did it go? I don't know. I'm sure I'll look for it somewhere and find it.
Okay.
Sorry.
It's okay. The BBC acts and dresses like professional businessmen, and there was a really choice Pet Shop Boys money montage going on. Really think beginning of Beverly Hills 90210, the first season.
Nice.
See, I tied it all together. However, the actual operation seems to just be them spending the investors' money.
Paradox philosophy.
That was close. I said paradigm. They do manage to get a scientist to sign over the marketing rights to an energy machine, and they kind of skip through a bunch of stuff because this is when Ron Lemon also shows up. Ron Lemon, who is played by Ron Silver, RIP, he is very leery of this whole scenario, but he does give Joe Hunt an account to prove himself. Joe makes like $14 million.
Yeah. He always has really good luck at first, and then it's like they don't know when to get out. You gotta, like Kenny Rogers says, you gotta know when to hold them.
Mm-hmm. No one to hold them, no one to fold them.
No one to walk away.
Yep. But, so they make like $14 million, and they end up buying cars and condos with it, so that the BBC can live and work together, which is really weird. That's a lot of time spent with people. The joy is short-lived, though, when Joe realizes that the money wasn't real. And he was used by Levin to convince actually another firm into writing a sizable loan. So Joe, during this time, also meets a guy named Booker, who becomes...
T. Washington, a wrestler?
Nope. Oh. They just call him Booker. He becomes a member of the BBC because he knows hand-to-hand combat, and he plays with guns.
Oh, so this is...
Pittman, I'm guessing. Joe is also very pissed off that Levin tricked him and schemes to get Levin to sign over what he promised, and then he's just going to murder him. So, and actually, let me go back a couple steps. He brings in the members of the BBC and asks them if they would be willing to kill anyone. Most of the guys say no, but then he gives like some scenario about like, well, what if your mother was raped? Would you kill then? And because he just talks about how you have to change your perspective. It was totally bizarre. So Joe meets up with Dean Carney, and he's like, you know, one of those top BBC guys. And he tells Joe that Levin is dead. So we kind of, again, skips around a lot. Even though it's 3 hours. Joe recounts that he went to Levin for a meeting which was then broken up by Booker, who was pretending to be a debt collector for the mafia. The debt collector for the mafia is after Joe, so what they were supposed to make it look like was that the debtor, aka Hunt, would repay the creditors, aka BBC, with the money owed to him by Levin. And after Levin writes Joe a check, he realizes that he's about to be murdered. And, of course, they kill him. They dump the body in a canyon in California. And soon Levin's family and friends contact the police about his disappearance. But it's discovered that Levin had served time in jail for credit card fraud and wire fraud. The authorities believe that Levin's going missing really has nothing, has really everything to do with people that he probably stole from or tried to get one over on. And at a BBC party, Joe meets Reza Nabuadi, who is a friend of a BBC member, and he wants to become a member. Reza is from Iran and says his father was an opium kingpin who made enemies, and he wants to take over his father's empire. So Joe recruits Booker and Dean Carney in a plot to kidnap the father and torture him, talking him into giving control of the assets to his son and the BBC.
So in the movie, do they make it seem like Reza knows about it?
No, they kind of make it seem like they didn't make it seem like he knew anything about it at first.
Oh, yeah.
So they also plot to murder him as well. So Booker and Joe, they impersonate delivery boys to gain access to the house. And then they lock Reza's father in a steamer trunk and put it in a camper for transport to a safe house. However, the kidnapping goes totally wrong, obviously because he starts to run out of air. So Dean Carney, punches holes in the trunk for air, but then ends up sealing the holes with duct tape because they heard shouting. And Joe is freaking out because he's worried that other cars are going to hear the guy yelling. So later on, Dean opens the trunk and he finds that Reza's father is unconscious, and Joe's yelling at him to do CPR, but of course it's too late. And so he's dead, and Joe is annoyed, but they dispose the body in the same canyon where they dumped Levin. Meanwhile, everything is not okay with Joe because investors are now wanting to withdraw funds or close accounts. And some of the BBC start to get legal counsel, and they turn him in.
Those pesky May brothers.
Yes, those May brothers. They turn him in about what happened to Levin, as well as the list. They provide the list to the cops.
Oh, so it wasn't found in the house like it was in real life.
So the trial, so like I said, this whole time they kind of bounce back and forth between the trial, and Joe doesn't take the stand in his own defense, but he is found guilty. The crowd really murmurs, and the judge ends up giving him life without parole.
Yeah.
So a voiceover comes on and states that Joe is in jail waiting a second trial for the murder of Reza's father. Booker, his first trial against, for the murder of Levin actually resulted in a hung jury. Mm-hmm. And the second trial was in progress at the time of the airing.
What is up with these juries in California? Why can't you get things right? I mean, seriously, OJ did it.
Right?
So did these guys.
Dean Carney, has another identity. He's in the witness protection program. And for turning in state's evidence against Joe Hunt. But it also ends with a quote from Joe's high school yearbook in 1977. "These are endless galaxies which are yours. You can journey to infinity through endless passages of the cosmos. Even better, this all belongs to you. This is your mind."
Was that from
Toy Story? I don't know what it's from.
To
infinity and beyond. Yeah. So that was a banner of a film.
So they took some liberties.
Yes. And I did read
Dean Carney a little more culpable than...
Yeah. I read on Wikipedia about the movie that actually Joe Hunt filed an injunction against NBC trying to get them to not air the movie because he was worried that it was going to taint the jury pool for his second trial.
Oh.
And he ended up losing, and so the movie aired.
Mm-hmm.
But the family of Joe Hunt also said that they felt that the movie was very one-sided, and that it was basically all of the information that they used was actually what Dean Carney had told the police and stuff like that. So they felt that it was very one-sided and it didn't tell the whole story. But that is.
Makes you wonder what they think the whole story actually is.
Sorry, I bumped into the microphone. Yes, it does make you wonder.
Scuzz is a scuzz is a scuzz.
Right.
To use the 80s term.
Yeah. Like, totally, man. So, yeah, that was the movie. It was long. I didn't enjoy this one as much.
No.
No.
I was going to say, because there was no murder, but there
was even
murder.
Though there was lots of synthesizer. And
is that what determines the quality of a movie for
yes,
you?
Yes. If it uses an obscene amount of synthesizer.
So Wedding Singer is great for you.
Yes. I enjoy The Wedding Singer a lot. But this was not good. So there was lots of mullets. There was lots of bowl cuts. There was lots of things. It was definitely a movie about excess.
Yeah. And there was a Billionaire's Boys Club in
2017?
In India. No. Another Billionaire Boys Club.
Oh.
In India. And I think there's also when I was Googling it, there's a clothing line called Billionaire Boys
Club. I saw that because when I Googled.
But I think Pharrell might have something to do with.
When I Googled it too, like these different clothing lines came up and I was like, oh, how odd.
I don't know if I'd want to associate myself. I mean.
Or I hope at least Joe Hunt's getting some royalties from that shit.
It's like, do they understand the connotation of the Billionaire Boys Club? Maybe you
probably
shouldn't
not.
Name your clothing line after a group of Ponzi schemers and murderers.
You're correct.
But you have to, these, I shouldn't say poor kids because they are obscenely wealthy, but.
I'll use poor in quotes.
Yeah, they're wanting to establish a financial record of their own independent from their family, and then this guy comes in and takes advantage of them. I don't know. It's hard to feel sorry for him. As a poor person, it's hard for me to feel sorry for somebody with that much money who doesn't know how to control that much money. You're just giving it to people. Not that I'm victim blaming at all, because obviously nobody deserves that, but I don't know. I just don't understand the thought process.
I am with you. It's a lot.
Yeah.
So, anyway, that is our torrid tale for this week.
It is very torrid, very salacious.
So, you can, of course, rate, review, and subscribe. We like 5-star reviews. It helps us get our name and word out there. And we're on all of your favorite social media things. Platforms. That's the word I couldn't think of just now.
Or Based on a True Crime Story and Instagram, Based on a True Crime 1.
thanks for doing that because you know I struggle.
True CR1, that's on Twitter.
Email is Based on a True Crime Story @gmail.com. And yeah, rate, review, and subscribe. And
we're on Facebook.
Oh yeah, Facebook. We're on that too.
Yep.
So until next time. We will be back with another tale of crime and movie.
Sometimes some movies are crimes, but that's something separate. I'm looking at you, Midsommar.
All right. Until next time. Bye-bye.
Bye.